Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, October 26, 2015. America's national surveillance state continues to expand. Now it includes the tax man. Rockwell song from the mid-80s, produced by Michael Jackson, is prophetic. You heard the singer talk about the mailman watching you? Well, you know, every bit of mail that you receive is now scanned and is part of a national database. And in the final passage of that little ditty, at least that portion of it, he says, I wonder who's watching me now, the IRS? Well, here is the word. The Guardian newspaper is reporting that the Internal Revenue Service is the latest in a growing list of federal agencies known to possess Stingray. Now, I have been exposing Stingray for over 2 years now. It was Bo Hodai, the independent investigative reporter, who first scooped this issue. And Stingray is allegedly a secret, but it's not so secret anymore. It's a technology that comes in a box made by the Harris Corporation in Florida. It started out at the federal level, and then the FBI started pushing it out to local law enforcement agencies, and that's how we discovered it. Stingray acts as a simulated cell phone tower, and it requires every phone within a certain radius, a couple of miles, to check in with it and disgorge not only your phone number, your serial number, but it can also access your voicemail. It can access your phone call records, your call and, you know, outbound and received calls. It can listen to conversations. But we're told not to worry, because the government uses this in the most responsible possible way. And even though it sucks in the data of hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent people within its range, they say, don't worry, we flush all that information. We only save the stuff related to our targeted suspects. Do you believe that? Well, the Guardian's report is that since 2009, the IRS has been buying from the Harris Corporation Stingray 2, a Hailstorm device, and we don't know what they're using it for. And they claim that they're allowed to use this under the ancient pen register regulations that were used to tap landline telephones decades ago. And this is just another crazy situation. We know at least 12 different federal agencies have these devices. The IRS makes it a lucky 13. At least 20 states have local police agencies that use Stingray. And in most cases, the evidence that is derived is shielded from the defendant, the suspect, his lawyers, and from the judges who preside over trials where this information can be used. Now, we also have learned that they often do parallel investigations. Once they find out that somebody robbed a bank using Stingray, well, they will find other evidence to incriminate that individual and try to avoid using the Stingray information in court. But this is a clear violation of our Fourth Amendment right to be free of search or seizure without probable cause and a court order. And this is another intrusion in our constitutional rights that has occurred as we've had a president who claims credentials as a former constitutional law instructor. And two questions come up here. Did the IRS use Stingray to ensnare Dennis Hastert, the former Republican Speaker of the House, who is entering into a guilty plea to avoid a trial that he structured transactions of hush money to a boy, now a man, who he molested when he was a high school wrestling coach decades ago? And just last night, we were barbecuing some oysters with friends. My friend Sharon told me that because they put a solar system on their house, They have a huge refund due by the IRS to them since April 15th. They filed their taxes in March. And I don't know the exact amount of the refund that they're due, but it's tens of thousands of dollars. And Sharon said she keeps checking with the IRS, and they said, well, they're processing it. But, you know, we're understaffed right now. And it's true that Congress has cut the budget of the IRS in retaliation for the scandal that came out of the Cincinnati nonprofit division, where they were giving what I think was appropriate scrutiny to political groups who wanted to pretend to be nonprofits so they wouldn't have to disclose their donors. And recently, that office was exonerated. You may or may not buy into that. There are a lot of people who think that it was unnecessarily political. But I can tell you that there were liberal organizations that encountered the same delays as they were trying to acquire nonprofit status. And so I guess the FBI is just so busy putting out fires about Lois Lerner's missing emails and declining to pay Tom and Sharon the refund that they've been due since April. And they must be diverted over there at the Stingray machine. Dragnet capturing the data of thousands of innocent Americans. Well, I was stunned to read this morning. Tony Blair has finally apologized. The former Prime Minister of Britain, in an interview on CNN with Fareed Zakaria, says that he is sorry for taking Britain into the war in Iraq. And I'm glad to hear this. I have to say that Fareed Zakaria is a surprise to me as the guy who would pop a question like that and get Tony Blair to make this admission. Zakaria is such a tool of the Beltway and the corporate consensus. So this is unusual in that it was Zakaria and that Blair has finally apologized. And he said, let me quote here, he was asked directly whether the decision to enter Iraq and topple Saddam Hussein had been a mistake. You know, whenever I'm asked this, I can say that I apologize for the fact that the intelligence I received was wrong. Because even though he had used chemical weapons extensively against his own people and against others, the program in the form we thought it was did not exist in the way that we thought. This is convoluted. So I can apologize for that. I can also apologize, by the way, for some of the mistakes in planning and certainly our mistake in our understanding of what would happen once you had removed the regime. But I find it hard to apologize for removing Saddam. I think even from today, 2015, it's better that he is not there than he is there. Really? And then he was asked whether the invasion of Iraq was the principal cause of the rise of ISIS. He said, I think there are elements of truth in that, but we've got to be extremely careful, otherwise we'll misunderstand what's going on in Iraq and Syria today. Then he tried to spin it up this way. Of course, you can't say that those of us who removed Saddam in 2003 bear no responsibility for the situation right now. But it's important also to realize, one, that the Arab Spring occurred, and two, ISIS actually came to prominence from a base in Syria and not in Iraq. Well, that's narrowly correct. But when you look back just a page or two in history before they entered the vacuum of the civil war in Syria from neighboring Iraq, it's that many of the leaders, including al-Baghdadi, the leaders of ISIS, were all locked up under American control during the occupation in prisons in Iraq. And that was the breeding ground that created this monster that we stoked as long as it was against the Assad regime. And until it turned on us, well, we didn't think they were so bad, so barbaric. And Jason Leopold, late on Friday, republished an important article from earlier this year regarding the phony intelligence that Tony Blair just referred to. And I'm linking to this article so that you can read it for yourself. It was published in March of this year. But it clearly shows that the Bush administration ignored the warnings that the intelligence operatives inserted in a critical report back in 2002 about mobile weapons labs, about WMD in Iraq. and that most of the qualifiers were dropped as the report made its way from the analysts up through the political chain of command. And the issue about whether Al-Qaeda was in Iraq, when you read the disclaimers and the statements, you know, as with much of the information on the overall relationship, details on training and support are secondhand. The presence of Al-Qaeda militants in Iraq poses many questions. We do not know to what extent Baghdad may be actively complicit in this use of its territory for safe haven and transit. Then there's the case of Al-Libi. The source who later recanted his claim about the mobile weapons labs because he had been tortured into coughing that up. And so I hope that as you process Tony Blair's apology, you also take a look at Jason Leopold's great reporting. Well, for the past few days, John Kerry's been huddling with Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas, respectively, the Israeli and Palestinian leaders. And after the huddle, Kerry told reporters that all the violence and the incitement to violence must stop. Leaders must lead. And he said he got buy-in on that from both Abbas and Netanyahu. But today we get word that Benjamin Netanyahu has raised the possibility of revoking resident status and travel rights of some Palestinians living in East Jerusalem. Now, the Israelis, of course, are victims, and they claim they have to do this to stem the violence that is occurring today. Such a move did not appear to be imminent or even politically feasible, but its mere mention ran counter to a decades-old Israeli assertion that Jerusalem is an undivided city where Israeli Jews, Palestinians, Muslim, and Christian enjoy equal rights. And from the PLO, Hanan Ashrawi, a very astute observer, said, "This alarming escalation, an inhuman and illegal measure, must be stopped immediately." And this is what I have been speculating. Is the real motive here? Israel keeps saying status quo, and the holy sites, we're not going to change anything, but maybe we'll change this. And through the Kerry-brokered huddle, there is an agreement now to install video cameras at the holy sites, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But the Palestinians are a little reluctant on that. They think that the Israelis will use that to find suspects and further oppress Palestinians. And so it's not an easy picture, and Netanyahu, after his remarkable comments last week, blaming all Palestinians for the Holocaust because a Grand Mufti back in the 1930s had a couple of meetings with Hitler. So John Kerry is really unable to leverage any cooperation from Netanyahu, who keeps going off like a lunatic, and he sounds like a cross between Donald Trump and Ben Carson on a bad day. Now, here's a report that a Facebook friend posted, and I want to acknowledge that it is a single source. I haven't received confirmation from a corporate media outlet. And the source is an Arab website, and it reads, "The U.S.-backed moderate rebel fighters of the Free Syrian Army have released more images from the Hama Governorate's northern countryside." Hama is a city in Syria. This time, the images include the mutilated heads of captured Syrian soldiers that were executed by these alleged moderates over the weekend. In addition to the images, these moderate rebels that are allied with Jabhat al-Nusra also issued a threat to the Syrian government, to the Syrian population, which included a promise that they would behead more Syrian Arab army soldiers who they consider all Alawis, or Alawites, despite the army being predominantly Sunni. The U.S.-backed moderate rebels have attempted to distinguish themselves as a different breed of anti-government fighters than the hardline Islamic groups like Jabhat al-Nusra and Jund al-Islam. But this just shows, and, you know, Putin made a comment, a kind of offhand remark last week in his speech in Sochi in Russia, where he said, you know, what is a gentle beheading? And, you know, what are these moderate fighters? And it just underscores the ludicrous nature of the claims the United States has been making, that we carefully vet these people, we only work with, you know, people we can control and influence, and it's just horseshit. That's all it is. Every day I like to stop for a minute and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast, people who have a subscription, like Bob Donjacour, Deborah Kennedy, Faith Peoples, and Robert Ripner. Robert just renewed his annual subscription. Thank you very much. And I want to invite you to become a subscriber. A couple of people signed up over the weekend, and I'll get their names in a shout-out here in the next few days. But I'd like you to be next. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. On the homepage, there's a menu button in the upper right corner. You click on that and pull down. Next, you'll see an option to open a subscription, take out a new subscription. And when you click on that, you find a page that gives you options of $5, $10, $20 a month. You can make a one-time contribution of any amount, or you can take our $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers get the bonus gift, Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos ebook. And don't forget, we've got the Apple app in the App Store for iPod and iPhones. Well, the Pentagon is raising the alarm that Russian submarines and spy ships are aggressively operating near the vital undersea cable routes that carry almost all global internet communications and, don't forget, a lot of military communications. And it's hard to know if this is a calculated leak by the Pentagon intended to raise tensions with Russia, or if it is a response to Russian aggressiveness as part of the Cold War 2.0. For me, that's an open question. Now, we know from news accounts that the Russians have been pushier, crossing into airspace and sending ships into domestic waters of neighboring countries. And so I don't presume to know. But I'm always suspicious when the Pentagon floats these kinds of warnings. And what they're telling us is, in private, they report that from the North Sea to Northeast Asia, and even in waters closer to American shores, they are monitoring significantly increased Russian activity along the known routes of the cables. Just last month, a Russian spy ship called Yantar, equipped with two self-propelled deep-sea submersible craft, cruised slowly off the east coast of the United States on its way to Cuba, where one major cable lands at Guantanamo Bay. It was monitored constantly by American spy satellites, ships, and planes. The level activity, said a senior European diplomat, notice that person isn't named here, is comparable to what we saw in the Cold War. And, according to the New York Times, what worries Pentagon planners most is that the Russians appear to be looking for vulnerabilities at much greater depths where the cables are hard to monitor and breaks are hard to find and repair. Now, I have it on good authority from sources in the U.S. Navy that during the 1980s, Russian mini-subs were able to penetrate San Francisco Bay. And at the time, there was an active submarine base at Mare Island, about 25 miles inland from the Golden Gate Bridge. And from what I learned, the submarines never made it past Alcatraz or, you know, up through the bay closer to that submarine base at Mare Island. But the source I have was very firm that Russian subs were in the bay back around 1983 or 84. Over the weekend, Bernie Sanders turned up the heat, the burn, on Hillary Rodham Clinton at the big, I think it was the Jefferson dinner in Iowa. Yeah, Jefferson Jackson dinner. He explicitly compared himself to Obama. 8 years ago, the experts talked about how another Democratic candidate for president, Barack Obama, couldn't win, how he was unelectable. Well, Iowa, I think we're going to prove the pundits wrong again. I believe we'll make history. And then he went on to call out Clinton, noting that she had long lagged behind him on a number of progressive causes, gay rights, Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Iraq War. And Sanders touted his opposition to that war. It gives me no joy to say that I was largely right about the war, I'm proud to tell you, when I came to that fork in the road, I took the right road, even though it was not the popular road at that time. Well, I'm glad to see, because Bernie's been a little too polite, a little too gentlemanly, and there are significant differences with Hillary Clinton. And just to be fair, I am still waiting for the burn to get specific on foreign policy, to tell us how he would end American involvement in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Afghanistan. He doesn't talk about these things, only when he's pressed, and in the debate there was a little discussion of it, where Bernie said he's okay with drone strikes and aerial flights over Syria, but no boots on the ground. And that is not a very good position from my point of view. It's a little different from Hillary, not as hawkish, not calling for a futile no-fly zone, but not challenging the incoherent and, as the New York Times editorial referred to it, hallucinatory policies of President Obama. Well, got news on a couple of Republicans who want to be president. And Chris Christie went on the CBS Face the Nation Sunday and said that the Black Lives Matter movement is calling for, quote, the murder of police. I don't believe that movement should be justified when they are calling for the murder of police officers, he said. And he also accused President Obama of supporting the movement and encouraging lawlessness while not backing up law enforcement. Now, Chris Christie is a former federal prosecutor. He's a man who has no concept of the deep wrongs, the deep injustices, particularly as applied to African Americans by our criminal justice system. And to hear him say this and to put it in such racist terms is really offensive. And he's echoing what Too Tall Jim Comey, the FBI director, said on Friday at a conference in Chicago. And he surprised some of his own staff members by embracing this idea that the pressure to force law enforcement to follow the law, to stop violating people's constitutional and civil rights, to stop brutalizing individuals in their custody, that somehow this is leading to a spike in crime rates. Now, if this is the case, it's because police officers are getting the blue flu. They're intentionally not doing their jobs. Because the inference from Jim Comey and Chris Christie is that the only way to properly crack down on criminals in this country is for law enforcement to operate outside the law, above the law, and with no accountability. And what we've seen in the last couple of years, starting with Ferguson and continuing to this day, is a justified challenge to the extremes of our criminal justice system and law enforcement. And to hear these I'll resist the urge to call a name, but to hear these two people trying to say that reining in police wrongdoing is leading to crime and therefore we should stop reining in the wrongdoing, that is deeply insulting, deeply offensive. And Chris Christie, after he was on TV in Washington, D.C., hopped the Amtrak train to go back to New Jersey. And maybe you've heard about this, but he ended up sitting in the quiet car. In the quiet car, the rules are it's supposed to be like a church or a library, no loud conversations and no cell phones. Well, he went in and he started yelling, first at his security detail. Apparently, you know, they screwed something up. Then he got on his phone and yelled at some more people, and fellow passengers got the sheepish conductor to come back and say, Governor, you can either have to shut up or get out of this car. And so under protest, he kept saying, I can't frickin' believe this. Are you serious? Big fat Chris Christie got up and moved to another car, and he has issued an apology. One of the guys who, like Chris Christie, thought he could be the next president of the United States is Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin. And Walker he figured out that he wasn't going to survive the clown car primary. So he pulled out about a month ago. And on Friday, in a step that he should have taken a long time ago if he really wanted to be president, he signed a law that repeals elements of Wisconsin's very progressive John Doe law. The John Doe law allows prosecutors to obtain search warrants and order people to testify and turn over documents in investigations that typically take place in secret. And why does Scott Walker want to get rid of this law? Well, because six of his aides or allies have been convicted as a result of the John Doe law and that type of investigation. And so the Republican idea of cleaning up corruption in Wisconsin is to prevent any future investigations into corruption. Isn't that swell? We often talk about the 15,000 paid FBI informants who are out and about in the United States right now. And these are the informants who become provocateurs when they enter into secret agreements with suspects. They put them up to a crime. And then when the suspect tries to detonate the bomb or pull the trigger, they swoop in and arrest him with television cameras rolling. And one of the key elements of this whole corrupt system of framing people for domestic terrorism involves testimony from snitches. And we learned the other day that one of those snitches, Ernest James Ujamaa, U-J-A-A-M-A, has been granted a release from federal prison with a much shortened sentence. I think he was supposed to serve 15 years, and he ended up doing about five, something like that. But he has testified in a number of trials, including a conspiracy to establish a jihadist camp in Oregon and other cases, including an Egyptian-born cleric who had been preaching at a mosque. That's Mostafa, who was convicted in 2014 on 11 terrorism charges, with Mr. Ujamaa delivering crucial testimony at his trial. And it's rare that we get a glimpse of this seamy side of law enforcement in America today. Now, a little bit of good news. As you know, President Obama has accelerated the release and shortened the sentences of about 6,000 nonviolent drug felons who are in federal prison. And some of those people have already been processed out to halfway houses. November 1st is the target date for all of these individuals. And I'm overall pleased about this because it is part of this long overdue effort to address the injustices in incarceration and the failure of the war on some drugs. But buried in this Associated Press article with a lot of feel-good stories about, Lincoln White, age 43, was caught buying 2 ounces of cocaine in Florida in 2008. He served more than 5 years of a 7-year sentence. And he has plans for a job and a girlfriend when he gets out. But buried in this story is a little detail, a factoid. About 2,000 of these 6,000 being released are being deported. Now, there's no other information about these people being deported. But consider that there are many people who are in this country without citizenship papers, yes, illegal immigrants, if you want to call them that. They committed a drug crime, went to prison, and now they're going to be deported to a country where they may have never lived. Or maybe they live there as a toddler, or were brought to the United States by their parents or however they got here. But to just summarily deport 2,000 of these people in order to empty prison cells is not consistent with the kind of new approach to incarceration that we were told this is all based on. I'll be looking for more information about those deportees, and if I can find it, I'll bring it to you. And finally today, I want to credit Margaret Sullivan, who is the public editor of the New York Times, because she's calling out her own newspaper for its failure to give adequate coverage to the recent blockbuster disclosures from Jeremy Scahill at The Intercept. This pulls back the curtain on the drone program, and just one of the elements that Scahill reported is that 90% of individuals killed in 1 5-month period by drone strikes in Afghanistan were unintended targets. And we're told that these are precision strikes, they're very careful about who they pick and how it's chosen and all this stuff. And actually, 90% failure rate is an improvement. It used to be 98%. And the Times, I did notice this, and I mentioned it on a News and Comment podcast at the time. When the story first came out, they gave it 4 lines at the very end of a story about the president's drone program. And they did credit The Intercept as the source. But Sullivan reports that a number of readers wrote to her and wanted to know why the Times hadn't provided more coverage. Matt Davis of New York City wrote, "Is the Times planning on covering the extensive leaked information regarding the Pentagon's drone warfare program?" He thought the lack of an article might be explained by misplaced patriotism or annoyance about being scooped by the upstart journalists. Sullivan asks the executive editor and the national security editor why the story had received relatively short shrift, and unfortunately she accepts their excuses, which I think are pretty lame. They said, we think it's interesting and there is something new there, but it's not something that warranted its own story, at least at this moment. And it's because the Times has done such a great job reporting on this issue already. Sorry. That doesn't wash. My bullshit detector just went off again. Hey, thanks for listening to my News and Comment podcast. You are free to share this, and I hope you will. Put it on Facebook, email it to a friend. And thank you. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.